You are listening to A Good Book on Sun Sounds of Arizona.
Kirin's The Spell of Noan, written and narrated by James D. Priest.
Lyodor touched Spekarin's shoulder and spoke Ruvan.
My aide has a surprising message.
Spekarin stood up quickly and stared at the messenger.
I went to her room, he said in Ruvan. She wasn't there. I asked the attendants about her. No one has seen her since last night. Thinking she might be attending to your Eilon, I went to the tunnel housing the birds. There were only three. I asked everyone I met, and no one had seen the woman or knew of the missing Eilon.
Not in her room, thought Spekarin, perplexed. A raven gone? How can it be?
Iliani is about, somewhere in the cave.
She found something unique to explore or someone fascinating to talk to, perhaps about the Fox Eilon.
That would be just like her.
What trials we've had! She's missing! No, he chuckled, calming himself. Her? She's a rock, a pillar of stability through all our adventures and misadventures.
She's never failed, never missed a beat. I'll go find her.
He glanced at Tali, then the Feranor. How much longer until she recovers?
This is hardly an exact science, said Lyodor. She might awaken any time. You should stay. When she awakens, she might need you.
Spekarin looked sternly at Hutt.
Stay with her. I'll return shortly with Deliani.
Leaving immediately, he descended the wall intently and strode to her chamber. He knocked loudly on the door, then entered. Scattered about were articles from her bags, the bags themselves, a nightgown, and leftover food, but no Deliani.
There, he thought emphatically. She can't be far. Her belongings are all here. She wouldn't have left without the important ones. And if for some reason she did, she would have straightened up the room before leaving. But where is she?
He departed, descended rapidly to the Raven's Tunnel, and entered. Three were there.
Manet,
he called, then looked carefully at each Eilon. Manet was missing. He searched the tunnel quickly and found nothing.
She must have gone outside to explore by herself, he thought, apprehension rising. That would be so unlike her. The faithful Deliani is gone. She'll return soon.
Standing among the Eilon, he realized how much this woman meant to him and the traveling party, and his sense of loss was profound.
What more can happen? We lose Jilin, one of the two with the knowledge. A distracted Tali falls. Hutt succumbs to the barwood tree. And now our heart and soul, my counterpart, Deliani.
Hutt entered the passageway.
I couldn't help it. I had to come and see about her. Did you find her?
No, and Manet's gone. Believe it or not, I had a premonition about this while flying home with Runagar. As we waited for Tali to awaken, Deliani was missing. The Shillitoes must help us find her.
He's right, thought the old magician. It makes no sense just to wait for Deliani. Again we need help, just when it seemed we might be fine and the party reunited. We must see the queen.
We'll find Deliani, said Hutt.
Climbing the wall to the throne room, Spekarin pondered Hutt's surprising premonition. Arriving on the promontory, the magician asked to see Lenara regarding a serious emergency. The ancient woman emerged shortly, assisted by attendants, who helped her sit on the throne.
What's wrong? She asked.
Deliani is missing, said Spekarin, a knot in his stomach. Will you help us find her?
Of course, said the queen. We'll organize search parties immediately. How long has she been gone?
No one has seen her since last evening.
No matter.
In her raspy voice, she barked apparent commands in the local dialect. Some attendants departed, concern on their faces.
We'll find her. She can hardly be far.
Her raven's missing also. They must be together and could be anywhere the bird's wings would carry them.
He knew little about his host's animal Eilon, but was quite certain they couldn't travel as fast as a raven.
Hutt and I have Bird Eilon and must be involved in the search.
Glaring, she aimed a shriveled finger at him.
You can be of no help in this matter. You have little knowledge of our cave and none of the surrounding environment. Even though your lad had an outing in the countryside, you'll remain here.
She pointed toward the Farinan.
Attend your fallen lass. Await the results of the essence, but do not venture outside our cave.
She struggled to her feet, turned away, and disappeared with her attendants into the corridor behind the throne, Speckeron staring after her, alarmed at her harsh tone and demeanor. He considered a chilling prospect.
This ancient queen knows more about Deliani's startling disappearance than she chooses to reveal.
Chapter 42. A historic occurrence was taking place at John Versteeg's hunting lodge. Two intelligent species who had occupied the same planet since prehistoric times, but for untold generations did not associate with each other, were again working together. As far as Ruggum and Jilin knew, it was the first time Kirans and humans had exchanged information for thousands of years. It was early evening by the time the old man finished treating Luana, and he had a suggestion for the Kirans.
Why don't you stay in the lodge?
Actually, for as long as it takes for the bird to heal. The boys and I won't be here all the time. We'll be in and out. Knowing how vulnerable Luana would be in the wild if unable to fly, Ruggum didn't refuse. The old man showed them to a bedroom on the lower level and switched on the overhead light. He suggested they occupy one or both beds, but the Kirans declined. In their natural habitat, they preferred being above ground, but here they had more of an aversion to human furniture than the floor. The man brought two cardboard boxes and cut and fashioned them for the birds to rest in. Then he left. Christopher and Nathan sat down on the beds and talked for some time with their tiny visitors. During the discussion, Jilin asked a question that was embarrassing to the boys, especially Nathan.
Why did you fire a weapon at us?
The explanation proved most difficult, both for the boys to give and the Kirans to accept. But discussing it at length, they all agreed it was a tragic accident, unforeseen and unpremeditated. At first considering it a disastrous waste, Ruggum then realized it had ironically brought Kirans and humans together for the first time in eons. John Versteeg appeared in the doorway.
Ask our guests whether they want something to eat or drink.
Christopher turned to Jilin.
Would you like anything?
I'm not hungry, said Jilin, but would like water.
He glanced at Ruggum, who nodded in agreement.
And some for the ravens, added the overseer.
Both Nathan and the old man departed, the man coming back with two saucers filled with water. He put them down in the cardboard boxes.
There's plenty more where that came from.
He left again. At first, his remark puzzled Jilin, who wondered where this water did come from. Then he remembered the sink and faucet, water gushing mysteriously from it to fill Loana's basin. Old Alsanam, Ruggum's bird, drank voraciously, but Luana couldn't touch a drop. Nathan returned with two metal thimbles, brimming with water, and put them on the floor near Jilin. The lad picked one up and drank gratefully. When Ruggum raised the other, it vanished into thin air.
Where did it go? Asked Nathan.
My friend's holding it, said Jilin.
When the overseer finished drinking, he put it back on the floor, and it was immediately in view. The boys were enthralled and had unending questions about Kirin magic, the purpose of the mission, where they lived, about Jilin, Ruggum, and Kirins in general, and about Eilon and clans. Jilin, whom they could see, answered as best he could with help from Ruggum. The Kirans asked about human culture, families, homes, hobbies, entertainment, and transportation. As the evening wore on, the Kirins became more at ease, presuming these giant beings meant them no further harm. John Versteeg reappeared in the doorway and listened for a while. "Time for bed, boys. Our guests, and especially the injured bird, need rest." Then he left. After delaying as long as they could, the boys finally went to their rooms. The Kirins settled on a throw rug near the wall farthest from the door and covered themselves with a small towel supplied by Christopher. The old man came back and asked whether they wanted the light on or off during the night. They were undecided and baffled by his explanation of electricity. But, in case they had to tend to Luana, they decided to leave it on. The man departed, leaving the door slightly open, and saying he left the sliding door to the upstairs deck partially open in case they wanted to go outside. "Right after Luana was shot," said Jilin, settling in, "you said it was with a human weapon. How did you know?"
"Some years ago," said Ruggum, "I was part of an expedition lasting several weeks. Before leaving, we were given training about human customs, especially those that might prove harmful to us. In case a situation like today's should arise, we learned about their weaponry. I chose not to circumvent this building and recognize the weapon too late."
The night passed painfully for the injured raven and for Ruggum, trying to sleep in this gigantic human shelter. He tossed and turned, feeling responsible for events of the previous day, and thought about the future, estimating they would be here for the bird's injuries to heal, a minimum of 35 days.
"But now," he thought, "she has a chance for recovery."
Restlessly changing positions, he wondered whether Jilin was awake. Glancing at the glaring light bulb, he wished he could see his companion, and concluded the overhead light was one reason he couldn't sleep. But the night was passing without incident, and finally he slept. Early in the morning, Christopher stole to the Kirin's room. Holding his breath, he pushed the door open, hoping they were still there. A smile crossed his face, and he lingered, watching the sleeping Jilin. He was amazed at their presence and everything they had discussed the evening before. Again, he resolved to help them in any way he could. He crept back to his room and got into his warm bed, thrilled that Kirins existed and two of them were actually here. The morning was sunny, and the Kirins and boys conversed on the deck overlooking the lake. Jilin did most of the talking for the Kirins, old Ruggum still ill at ease around the humans. The injured raven was encouraged to move about and given access to any place she could walk or climb in the lodge. Most of the time she stayed with her masters, absorbing the sun's warmth. Christopher turned to Jilin.
"Would you like to eat something?"
"I am hungry today," said the Kirin.
"What sort of things do you like?" asked Nathan.
"Berries, acorns, seeds, roots," said Jilin.
"Do you like green things?" asked Christopher.
"Some," said Jilin.
He glanced at Ruggum, standing beside Alsanam, a hand on the bird's shoulder. The overseer shook his head, then climbed aboard the Eilon.
"We'll find our own," he said. "Would you like to come?"
"I'll stay with Luana," said Jilin.
"I'll bring some back for you," said the elder.
Concerned about how Luana might obtain food, he and Alsanam lifted off and flew into the woods. Christopher had an idea. He got up from his chair and went to the refrigerator. Part of yesterday's lunch was a pea and cheddar cheese salad. Pulling out a box containing the leftover portion, he took out a pea, then found a pop bottle cap, placed the pea on it, and carried it onto the deck. Putting it down next to Jilin, he asked whether he'd like to try it. The Kirin sniffed it.
"It has a strange odor, a sweet one. I'll wait until Ruggum gets back."
"Oh, I know what it is," said Christopher.
He took the bottle cap, went to the kitchen sink, and washed any residual mayonnaise dressing off the pea and the cap. Placing them again beside Jilin, he said, "Try it now." The Kirin lad picked up the pea and sniffed it again. Taking a bite, he looked up at Christopher.
"Good.
he said, "and I'm hungry." Christopher prepared several more peas in the same fashion, Jilin eating them all. Christopher brought him a thimble of water, and he drank it, and thanked the human for his hospitality. When Ruggum returned, he was surprised Jilin turned down the food he'd brought back. "I'm full from what Chris gave me," said the lad. "It was delicious." For the most part, John Versteeg remained aloof, as he had the evening before, not nearly as comfortable as the boys with these tiny beings. But intermittently he stood in the doorway, listening. "To get strong again," he said on one occasion, "the injured raven will need food and water, too." He knew that ravens in the wild eat almost anything. "Would you like me to bring it something?" Jilin glanced at Ruggum, who nodded. "Yes," said the lad. The old man went to the kitchen, returned with a saucer of fresh water and a plate of ground beef mixed with raw eggs, and set them down on the floor beside Luana, Ruggum gazing down at the meat.
"What is it?"
The old man explained, and Ruggum nodded again. This time Luana drank eagerly, then turned her attention to the hamburger, which she relished. Alsanam stalked over to have a better look, and was about to partake himself when Ruggum let him know it was for Luana. Dutifully backing away, the old raven then looked on with envy. Observing the old human, Ruggum became increasingly interested in communicating with him, deeply appreciating how kind he was being with Luana, and thinking perhaps he and the man had much in common. That afternoon, sitting alone beside Luana, Jilin was struck with a sudden and unmistakable feeling. 2 days earlier, he had sensed that something dreadful happened to Tali. Now, having no idea where she was or what she was doing, he knew something was changing. Not knowing whether it was good or bad, he could only hope it was good. Feeling helpless and sad, he took out her thin, shiny disc and held it in his hand, remembering her vibrant green eyes, how they crinkled at the corners when she laughed, and her hair, golden in sunlight. "I wish Ruggum and I could be on our way," he thought, "but we await Luana's recovery, and it will be long. I wonder whether I'll ever see Tali again. Because of what lies ahead for us both, and because we've been apart so long, there's a good chance I won't, unless we both make it home." He gazed at the disc's image of Tali's great-grandmother, then turned it over and perused the words, recalling what Tali had said. Her great-grandfather was a notable explorer who carried the piece with him and eventually settled down with her great-grandmother. "Now I am the traveler carrying the disc," thought Jilin. "I only hope the outcome is as good for Tali and me." Fingering the disc's worn lettering, he knew Tali and her predecessors had rubbed it for good fortune. Rubbing it now, he hoped for luck, for Tali, himself, and all the explorers on the quest, wherever they might be. The following day, Mr. Versteeg announced that he and his grandsons would leave that afternoon for the city. "The boys have school to attend, but we'll be back in 5 days." A plentiful supply of water was left for the visitors, and the sliding door to the deck was again left far enough open for them to go outside. The humans said goodbye, locked the other doors, and departed. Alone, the Kirins felt an unexpected void. Leaving Luana by herself for short periods of time, they shared Alsanam's back and explored nearby terrain. The remainder of the day and night went by without incident. They spent the next 4 days at the lodge. On the fifth, as promised, the humans returned. Happy to see them, the Kirins greeted them warmly. Going immediately to Luana, the old man examined her dressings and their supporting structures. Nothing was wrong, but he suggested changing the gauze pads because of minor drainage from the wounds. Ruggum concurred, and they went downstairs to the shop room where they worked together replacing the dressings. This time, Ruggum, invisible to the human, didn't rely on Jilin for translation, conferring with the old gentleman directly, each adapting his English so the other would understand. John Versteeg had required a few days to come to grips with the fact that these miniature creatures existed. He had, of course, not mentioned them to anyone. Now, on his return, he was willing, even eager, to associate with them. For the next 2 days, before the humans again departed, Ruggum and the old man spent most of their time together, Ruggum's English improving. Discussing good things and bad about Kirin's, humans, and the world, the wisdom of these elders of different yet coexisting races passed freely between them. Jilin, Nathan, and Christopher were involved in a similar but less philosophical exchange, and time passed swiftly for everyone. Assuming Luana's injuries would heal, they knew their time together was limited. The humans returned to the city to carry on their regular lives, and the Kirins could do nothing but wait, frustrated but grateful they had shelter for Luana and themselves. On the third day after the humans' departure, John Versteeg returned alone. The Kirins asked about the boys, and he said they were in school. Mildly embarrassed, he stated he had come to visit his guests to make certain they were all right, not acknowledging that he had become increasingly captivated by everything about them, their magic, their knowledge of nature, and the relationship between Eilon and Master. In truth, he couldn't stay away. He wouldn't remain overnight for fear of drawing suspicion from his family. The Kirin's presence, he assured them, was a secret shared only by him and his grandsons. Over the 12 days the Kirins had been there, Ruggum Chamter had grown fond of Mr. Versteeg. Moved he had come by himself to visit them, Ruggum realized the old man was doing all he could to help. The two elders retired to the workshop to check Luana's progress, Jilin going with them. The Kirins climbed the leg of the workbench, then watched the old man inspecting the raven. Everything seemed satisfactory. Ruggum announced that the tape binding the wing to the body could be eliminated, allowing her to begin moving the wing, and John Versteeg removed it.
"I can see Jilin, of course," he said, finishing his work, glancing at the lad. "In fact, I saw him on Luana when she was falling after Nathan shot her. Did you know that? These old eyes are sharp. But Ruggum, my friend, it's too bad I'll never see you. How do Kirins look when they get older? Grayer, balder, and plumper, like humans?"
Ruggum had a strange urge, a strong one, one he knew other Kirins had experienced, but hadn't dreamed he would himself. Uncertain what to do or how to do it, his faith and trust in this human made him wish to try.
"I'll try to show you."
Standing on the surface where they had nursed Luana, he made an effort to become visible. After several false starts and inconstant results, he gradually, but only for a few moments, overcame the ancient spell of Noan. Surprised and pleased, the old man stared as the air shimmered and flickered, then coming into full view was the Kirin.
"So you're Ruggum Chamter. I've wanted to meet you, or see you, for quite a while. You have a gray beard, and your feet are the same as Jilin's. What do you have in your belt, an axe?" "Well," he said, the small figure fading into nothingness, "I'm glad to have seen you, even for such a short time."
Moved by his companion's act, Jilin knew why he did it, and how radically his attitude toward this human had changed.
"Being from different clans," he thought, "at home I didn't know him very well, but he has a side no one ever sees. What would Spekeren think of what he did? And Deliani?" Spekeren for once would be speechless, and Deliani astonished.
Then picturing Tally, he beamed.
"She'd probably laugh."
It was a happening, of course, neither Ruggum nor John Versteeg would forget. Later, when Ruggum told how it felt to want to be seen and to be seen by a human, the sensations were impossible to describe. So long have the races been separated, so dependent are Kirins on Noan, and so distrustful are they of humans, that intentional encounters between the species are exceedingly rare. An occasional Kirin has shed the cloak of invisibility. Ruggum and Jilin discussed that after their surprise encounter with the small human girl by the pond, when she saw Jilin and said, "Hello." Ruggum had asked Jilin whether he sensed any pleasure being near the human, the lad vehemently denying it. Ruggum had never understood why a Kirin would choose to become visible, considering it a betrayal of the Kirin race. But now he knew how profound a desire it was, a primal urge, one he didn't know was there, welling up deep inside, its origins in the ancient bond between the races. And something else happened at the moment he was visible. He had more hope the races might be reunited than any Kirin on Earth. For the next 3 days, the Kirins were alone. Under Ruggum's watchful eye, Luana began moving her wing, gently at first, amplifying the motion day by day. She seemed to have little discomfort, and the Kirins rejoiced that her healing was on schedule. She was far from ready to fly, but an end to their waiting was in sight. During the fourth night after the old man's departure, the Kirins were sound asleep on the floor of their room, the ravens nearby. Jilin was dreaming of soaring on a strong and mended Luana when something invaded his fantasy. Someone was calling his name, but it wasn't Ruggum's voice. "What an unusual dream," he thought, and from Luana's back he looked down to see who was calling. Below was only darkness, no one in sight. But he thought he might be partly awake and tried to listen. His name came several times in a sweet, familiar voice. "Who's calling?" he asked, eyes still closed, not certain whether he was awake or asleep. When the answer came, he relaxed, satisfied he was still dreaming, happy this was part of his dream.
"Jilin, it's me."
He recognized the voice. It was none other than Tally's.
Kirins, The Spell of Noan, written and narrated by James D. Priest.
To learn more about Kirins, visit www.kirinbooks.com.
You have been listening to A Good Book on Sun Sounds of Arizona.